It's all about people. It's all about the relationships you build. And you know, I've been talking a lot about evidence and data, and it sounds so abstract. Seriously, it's been the relationships that I build that have helped me the most. Hello everyone, my name is Candela Iglesias, and I'm the founder and director of Alanda Health, and you're listening to the Public Health Insight podcast.
Before we move on, it is important to note that the views expressed in this podcast are our own and do not necessarily represent any of the agencies or organizations we work for or are affiliated with.
Well, Sean Benedict, what's going on? It's been a while since we've done one of these.
Yeah, although we do weekly episodes, it's not every week that we're actually recording in our studio. So it's finally exciting to get back. I think it's been over 2 months for me since getting back on the mic. So I should be asking you, how's it been?
I had to get you a new fancy microphone for you to come back on here. Why was that?
You know, sometimes we just have to take a break. Didn't Michael Jordan take a little break before coming back and winning some titles?
Do you think you're Michael Jordan?
I'm not saying that. You know, I'm just saying some stories out here.
Let's get to the topic of hand. So this is our first recording of the new year. So happy new year, everyone. In this episode, we'll be speaking to someone who knows a great deal about what it means to use evidence in public health. As we know, evidence is critical for evaluating the success of our interventions and generating the theories for which we base our interventions on and throughout the implementation process. So there's a lot to unpack with evidence, and we have a very special guest on to talk about some of those gray areas that would be very useful for people and public health practitioners.
Absolutely. So let's hear more about who we have on.
You want to hear?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. My name is Gordon, in case you forgot, and I'm the host for this episode, and I'm joined by my co-host, LaShawn Benedict, and we will be interviewing a special guest. Candela Chiesa Iglesias holds a Master of Science in Public Health from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and completed her PhD research and Master's in Microbiology Virology at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. Her aspiration is to do her part to ensure good health and well-being for all, especially for the most vulnerable. She is passionate about using evidence to improve programs in humanitarian and development settings. Candela is also the author of Build Your Dream Team, Leadership Based in a Passion for People, and the founder of Secan Leadership, a platform helping people from non-managerial careers, particularly in the sciences and health fields, to become stronger leaders. For years, she has worked supporting international NGOs, multinational organizations, and health institutions to strengthen their results by using interventions that are proven to work, strengthening their data, and reinforcing leadership and team building.
Candela, welcome to the Public Health Insight Podcast.
Hey, thank you. So glad to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Wonderful. We're so glad to have you. So what we like doing here at the Public Health Insight Podcast is to start by visualizing your career using Google Maps, so a GPS. So we know that in everyone's career, there's always those red lights, those green lights, traffic might be in the road, you might have to take a U-turn. We kind of want to visualize your career in that sense. So we know that you have a master's degree, a PhD degree, a master's in public health, and you own your own company. But fill us in a bit about the twists and turns that happen and the detours.
Wow, there's been a lot of those. I like the GPS analogy. So I was going to be a marine biologist. Maybe we can start there.
Marine biologist.
Yes, wow. Indeed. Okay. And then when I started by studying a bachelor's in biology, and throughout that, I decided that after doing like a 6-month stint with researching marine turtles in some faraway islands, I decided that maybe that was not for me. So then I switched to the lab. I switched to virology and immunology, which were also things that I was quite passionate about. And I ended up doing my master's of science and my PhD and a postdoc in virology and immunology, working a lot with HIV and vaccine development, actually. And that's where the second turning point came, because after 10 years dedicated to building my career in the biomedical science, one day I decided that I just couldn't do it anymore. It was just it was just too far away from actually helping people. Biomedical science is super important, and I am so, you know, so thankful to all the people that work in that area. But it had come to the point where it had become too heavy for me personally. So that was a very interesting red light, I would say, because it can be quite hard to change careers. And over the years, I've mentored a lot of people trying to do that, especially from the biomedical sciences, because that's my background. And I think we get really formatted in a scientific way, and we have like these 10-page CVs. And so it was quite challenging to define what I wanted to do next, and then to actually find the confidence to take that path. But eventually, after a year and a lot of support from a lot of people, I started a master's in public health, and I switched jobs to working in a hospital, leading a team working on mental health and psychosocial support. So that was the beginning of my new career. And quite a few years after that, I started working on my own as a consultant, and which eventually led to the founding of Alanda in 2020, which was also a big change because it meant going from working on my own to starting to build up a team again. And I can talk more about that later, but thinking about what are the things that we want to change? Where do we actually want to have an impact, and finding the ways to develop our own projects where we see the gaps.
And so you're the founder and director there.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about what Alanda Health does and maybe how that vision came together. You talked about feeling like your purpose was to fill some of the gaps that you saw. So kind of walk us through that part of the Google Maps journey.
Great. Yeah. So when I moved from what I would call public health to global health, and, you know, I think that distinction is sometimes a little bit of a fake one, but let's keep that. I started working a lot in the humanitarian and development sector, and I started supporting many NGOs and multilateral organizations working in global and public health. My strong area is evidence, everything related to evidence, and I know we'll talk more about that later. But I could see that there was a disconnect between the world that I came from in the biomedical sciences and in the, you know, the clinical science, like, you know, clinical trials and etc., and what was happening in these organizations, in these NGOs, working, you know, developing projects on the ground, helping people in different places, help supporting communities with these interventions in terms of evidence needs. And it got to a point where I kept seeing the same gaps come up again and again. And it gets quite frustrating, right, as a professional. And it's like, okay, I'm not really helping, you know, I'm just putting patches where I can. We're not addressing the core problem here. I think that was one thing. And the other thing was at some point it got lonely, I guess. I missed having a team and working together with other people. Of course, we always work in very close contact with our partner organizations, and I really care about that. And I sometimes worked with other consultants, but it's not the same as having your own team and doing that team building and that skills building and seeing people grow. I think that's a part that I was also missing, the synergies and the things that you can accomplish when you work together with other people. So those were the two main drivers of Alanda. I wanted to have the capacity and the structure that would allow us to keep on doing what we're doing in terms of supporting organizations with their evidence needs or their sometimes very specific technical needs in global and public health, but also being able to develop our own projects where we see gaps and where we would like to, in specific areas where we'd like to contribute more.
And in public health, and maybe in the general public as well, there's a lot of appreciation for evidence, and especially in practice as well. So we know it's important. On the other hand, not all evidence is created equal, and not all evidence is used in appropriate ways. So can you talk us through Alanda Health's approach to, I think you have a 3 E's approach to how you would work with organizations from an evidence-based perspective. Can you walk us through what that looks like and why this particular framework was chosen by your organization?
It came quite organically, actually. This 3 E's framework that we talk about at Alanda is what sort of helped us organize the ways where we can support organizations and where we see the gaps around evidence. So these 3 E's are what we call evidence. It's evidence-based, evidence-generating, and evidence-sharing. It's a little framework that we use at Alanda to support us in our thinking around evidence. And I think it's very important because otherwise, what I saw is that when I talked about evidence, people thought about being evidence-based, which is great. It's a great start. Don't get me wrong. I'm super happy if we can start there. But it's not the only thing, right? So what we see is, I think this framework covers the 3 areas where we normally see gaps in the work that we do with partner organizations, humanitarian and development organizations. And that is, the evidence-based is, okay, have you actually, you want to implement this new project or this new intervention, have you actually checked the literature to see what's out there on one side? And on the other side, is this in line with the needs on the ground, right? And I think that's something that sometimes we also see a lot is, oh, we think this is the solution. Yes, but you're not the person with the problem. You're not the community with the problem. Can we go and talk to them? Can we do a needs assessment, right? So these 2 areas are the areas where we work most on, the evidence-based component. Carrying out the literature reviews to see what's out there, what has worked, where has it worked, what were the key components, etc. And then the needs assessment, you know, what's happening really in the communities that you want to support, that you want to work with. The truth is, what we see is the global evidence base that we have in global health for many interventions, especially community-based interventions, it's not very strong. It's nothing comparable to what you have for drugs and medicines, treatments, and so on the clinical side. It's getting stronger. We see a very strong push, especially in the past 10, 15 years, towards being more evidence-based, which is great. But there's still a lot of gaps. And of course, there's a lot of fantastic organizations trying to fill these gaps. So that's the first one. The second one is, it's perfectly fine to innovate, right? It's fantastic that someone's going to try something new. But do you have the right framework to actually be able at the end of it to tell me if it works or not? Because if you're not, and we keep doing this and we keep seeing this over and over again, it's such a waste of time, resources, and effort, right? So can we actually set things up in a way that we would be able to tell if it works or not? And, you know, we know it's not as easy to do what we call operational research or implementation research as it is to do research in a lab or even in a hospital, you know, in a clinical setting with all the rules and regulations of a clinical trial. But we need to get better at it. And you have to have at least some sort of, you know, we call them monitoring and evaluation frameworks to make sure that you can capture the data that you need and at the end actually analyze that data in the right ways. So we do a lot of evaluations. We get requests to do a lot of evaluations. So we come at the end. And it can get quite frustrating because at the end, it's sometimes too late, right? Like there's the evidence that or the data that we get has so many holes. And it's still brilliant that they're doing the evaluation. Don't get me wrong. It's better to do it even if your data is incomplete, even if there's issues. But I see 2 things. One is, there was a very strong monitoring and evaluation framework, but it was not implemented the right way. People get so busy with, you know, all the project implementation that it sort of gets left on the side. Or there was not a very strong one from the beginning. So we see both. And the third one is, great. I mean, you know what's the evidence behind the intervention you want to do. You have a great monitoring and evaluation framework. You capture your data. You do your report. And then that report is read by 5 people. that is not enough. Please share your data. Please, we need it. Mm. There are so many gaps. We need to start filling up that global health evidence base, right? And it's up to all of us to get better at it. There's just not the tradition that we have on the clinical side or the biomedical side on, you know, conferences and abstracts and publishing data. So there's a lot of work to be done on that evidence sharing. I would say that's one that I see as the weakest pillar.
Mm-hmm. I want to dig a bit deeper for the first one, and we'll go a bit deeper into each one of these. So I wanted to start off at the evidence base. So myself and Gordon, we mentioned earlier before the recording that we have some microbiome background as well, biochemistry background. We've been able to delve in the scientific literature for various projects that we've been involved in. But the question that I hear often is, what actually is evidence? What constitutes evidence? And where does this evidence come from?
Mm. Yeah, I just think that it worries me that we are not talking more about this and that this question keeps coming up, right? I think it's on our side as scientists, as health professionals, etc., to get better at talking about what we mean about evidence. To me, it's the results that shows that something works or doesn't work. And it comes with a lot of caveats, right? It can work in a certain population, it can work for a certain age group, it can work in a certain setting. So all those details that will tell us, okay, if you try to reproduce this in these settings, it should work, right? And of course, you know, there's levels of evidence, and we talked about this a little bit before we started the recording. Not all evidence is created equal. And what I see, because I'm so passionate on evidence and I talk about it a lot, is that people don't necessarily know this. Like, even people that should know this better because they've been trained in some profession, etc., are not as familiar as they should be with it. So it's on the, you know, it's a systems problem as well that we need to fix. But it's not the same when you have, you know, a randomized clinical trial or, you know, bringing together data from several of these randomized clinical trials where you actually know, you know, you're trying to get rid of all the potential biases that we as human beings have, but also all the randomness that it's out there, as it is when you have a small study with just a few 10, 20 people. Or when you actually have not set up the conditions to do a comparison. What are you comparing to? It's fine. You can compare before and after. It's even better if you could compare a group that did not get the intervention or the medicine or the treatment against one that did. So we need to get better at talking not just about what evidence is, but the different types of evidence and how some are not better, but just stronger. Like we can trust them more than others. And that doesn't mean that there's no use into doing a study that does not use the highest quality setup that we can think of. This is particularly true when we're doing interventions, you know, in communities, when we're doing operational research. It's not that easy as it is, you know, in a clinical trial or in the lab to set up the conditions as properly. It's just that we need to be a little bit more careful about how we collect data and what data we collect.
So for public health practitioners, in terms of the evidence-based conversation, why doesn't that not happen more than it should? So is it a literacy problem, or is it a capacity issue for organizations or practitioners not using evidence to inform the programs that they design, implement, evaluate? Where is the breakdown as far as the public health professional or global health professional side of things when it becomes evidence-based?
On the public health side, I would say I guess it depends on the type of organization. So I think some organizations are more used to working with evidence and, you know, collecting the data and analyzing the data regularly. But we saw it. I mean, we saw it with the COVID pandemic, right? On the epidemiology side of things, the capturing of data or the sharing of data even was not fast enough, even, you know, in high-income countries, was not organized enough. The systems were not there. The frameworks were not there. So I see that there's a lot of gaps there. I think that some professions get hammered the data and evidence question much more in their studies than others in the healthcare setting in general. And it's something that we should all get pretty good at, whether you're a clinician, whether you're a public health practitioner, whether you're a global health practitioner. And it's not something that you just need to pass your studies. It's something that should become part of what you do in your everyday work, to advocate for more evidence, to be comfortable working with data. And that doesn't mean that you need to be able to use a statistical program and so on. There are people who specialize on this, but that you're comfortable interpreting data and making decisions based on it, right? And explaining that to other people, especially to decision makers, but also back, and this is something I can get really passionate about, is who are we not sharing data back to? And that is the people who gave us that data in the first place, the patients, the communities. We need to get so much better at that, so much better.
Mm. One of the things too, and this is so interesting to me, so we could probably talk for 2 hours, but we won't, I promise.
I'm in.
So when there's a lack of evidence, right, one of the things that I've seen in my experience is there's a problem. There's an attempt to look for solutions that are evidence-based. There might not be some, depending on what the issue is or what the context is. And then there's this, there's a call to action to still figure out a way how to address the issue. So, of course, it can be evidence-based in the sense that you're drawing conclusions from similar things or making theories that can be tested and implementing something. But I find in a lot of these cases, that's when you get maybe the wishy-washy interventions that are not really evidence-based and in terms of what addressing the issue. So how should the approach be when practitioners are in that situation where there's a lack of evidence for or against a particular issue?
Then it's the evidence generating part, right? That's where we get into the evidence.
Perfect segue.
That's where we get to the evidence generating part. And we should be doing this every single time, right? Because it's not just about, you might have the basis or the evidence there to say, oh, if I do A, B should happen, right? Like, okay, yes, we know that vaccines work. If you get kids vaccinated against measles, you will contain measles up to a certain point. If you have higher than 95% vaccination coverage, it's less likely than you will have an outbreak, etc. So there's things that we know for many, many years, many, many studies, many, many, you know, just implementation, which is great. But then there's other things that fall into this gray zone. They might have, and this is a lot when, you know, when it's complex projects, when it's complex interventions, where there's a lot of human side to it and how it's implemented, right? Which is why I was talking about community programs in general, right? Because it's about how good your community health worker is or your nurses, how well it's been trained, how much the system is supporting that person, how open the community is. There's so many variables. So it gets more and more complex. But that's when it comes to, do you have the settings and the people trained to actually be able to capture that data? And let's be honest, even in many hospitals, and even in many hospitals in high-income countries, that data collection part and data analysis and that research part of thing can tend to get relegated, unless we're talking about a teaching hospital or an academic hospital, etc., right? Whenever there's not a connection necessarily with academia, that part tends to get relegated. And it's not always sort of, and it's even worse, I think, in many NGOs. They are so busy and they're doing fantastic things. I mean, I see some programs that are like, this clearly is working, but I can't put my hands on fire and say it's working if I don't have the data to show it, right? Like, I think there's a little bit of resistance because of that fear that, oh my gosh, we've spent so much time and energy and money and this, they'll tell me that this is not working. No, most of the time it probably is, but you need to be able to prove it in a more systematic way, in a more rigorous way. That's for you, that's for your organization, but it's also for the rest of us, because then we can copy it. Then we know exactly how you did it and then we can copy it, right? It doesn't serve anyone that we're doing the same, trying the same interventions over and over again and not knowing whether it's going to work, or if I tweak this, would it work better? Or if I change this component, would it would work better?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that just come to mind is when we're talking about evidence generation, the idea of having these multidisciplinary teams and people from communities joining that evaluation process, the analyzing the data, talk about the ownership of data, having an epidemiologist on the team, having a data scientist on the team, having program implementation people on the team. Those bring different perspectives and it allows you to work with each other and build something better. Oftentimes in public health, we always talk about these silos, and it's when we're working in these silos, we keep missing and contributing to these gaps that are left in the evidence base at the end of the day. So having those interdisciplinary connections across sectors to make sure we bridge some of those gaps when it comes to the evidence sharing.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're totally right. We need these multidisciplinary teams. Let's be honest, there's a tension. There's a tension between the project managers and the program managers who want to go, 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 go. And, you know, data scientists, the epidemiologists who are like, yes, but we need to measure this, we need to collect the data, we need to do this. So there is that tension. And I think having those teams and having those discussions is super important, because then it's sort of the only way to find the balance, right? I've seen cases of not-for-profit organizations and international NGOs that are trying to get better at the evidence part, and sometimes they try to do it by joining with MIG teams. And they just say, but they don't understand what we're doing. Like, this is overwhelming. We can't be having these huge questionnaires asking this from the community. It just... And they're right? They're most likely right. They are the ones who know how challenging it can be to work in certain settings. So how do we find that balance? And those are important conversations to have, because there's not just one right solution. There will be a variety of them for each particular implementation or intervention or program.
And that's where I think it's very difficult, right? Because when we're doing some sort of grant application to get funding for a program where we have this research, monitoring, and evaluation, and there's tight deadlines to get those proposals and grants into place, how do you gather all these diverse stakeholders in such a timely fashion that you're able to have that important time allotment to have these discussions? So I think there's a lot of rethinking that has to be done, but you're right, these conversations definitely must be had.
And you touch on an important point, and there's even one point behind that, right? So what do we need to change in the system, in the donor system, to make sure, because donors are asking more and more for good data and for evidence and so on. But at the same time, I've seen, you know, requests for grants where you need to have the data from your needs assessment before requesting the money. And this is not possible. Like, where are some small organizations and not so big organizations going to find that money to do that, right? So you want a needs assessment. You need, like, the donor needs to step up and support that needs assessment. That's the first step. And if then you need to pull the project because, you know, it was wrong, or tweak the project, then that should be part of the way we do things. It should be incorporated into the system, the way we work with the grant management part.
Mm-hmm. And as you can already tell, I'm interested in the super practical side. So you had mentioned earlier about the importance of having a strong monitoring and evaluation framework at the time where whatever program, intervention, or project is being designed. What are some of those components of a strong monitoring and evaluation framework that you would recommend that every intervention should have?
It really depends on what's your basis, right? If this is something completely new, it's really important to have a baseline, right? That you measure several variables on a baseline. We call that a baseline assessment. So what is your starting point? what is certain health indicators in that community that are relevant for the intervention that you're measuring it? You know, if it's about child health, you need to have, you know, a general overview of what are the child health indicators in that area where you're going to work. And so you need to have those indicators. And then, okay, if at all possible, if your project is not going to be carried out more than one or two areas or one or two communities, is it possible and ethical to actually have a comparison group? And in some cases, it's not, and that's fine. But then it's also important to have that. Then it becomes even more important to have that baseline. So ideally, we would like to have a baseline for a group that will receive the intervention and a group that will not, or a community that will not receive the intervention, or that will receive, you know, the current way of doing things, the way we normally work, because, you know, it's not ethical sometimes, or in many cases, to not do anything. So when you're not really sure if something's going to work, you need to have another basis. And then you measure those two groups or communities over time until the end of your project. And I think what people get overwhelmed, what really creates that overwhelm or that resistance, is that sometimes I see, you know, 100 indicators. No, how do you make it easy? How do you make it? No, like, seriously, it gets so heavy for everybody involved, including the people you're supporting, the communities, the groups of people with a particular disease, whatever it is, right? So no, you don't need 100 indicators. I mean, you might in some very specific situations, but most of the time you need to find that balance that we were talking about between the practical and the doable. And you can't be knocking on people's doors to interview them every 3 months. How do you incorporate that component into the work that your community health worker is going to be doing? That is the easiest way sometimes. So there might be a ton of different solutions, but you need to think creatively about finding the right balance between the data collection and not overwhelming neither the team nor the communities, and in just focusing on certain types of the most important questions that you want to answer in that intervention or that project.
And the important part of that too, and you were kind of hitting on that, is the indicators should be appropriate for the length of the project. So if the project is a 6-month project and you're looking to reduce diabetes rates or something like that, then it's maybe not reasonable for diabetes and other diseases to have any change at the end point during that period. So picking the right indicator that would suggest that change could happen over time is very important as well.
And I don't want to get into the jargon, because we love our jargon, but, you know, we have these frameworks to think logically about these pieces, right? What are the high level indicators, the high level things that you want to impact in the end? And that might be mortality or morbidity. But then there's other indicators that happen before that, right? And that could be, people actually, the blood pressure for hypertension, the blood pressure started decreasing in people. Or it could be actually people are coming every 3 months to get their treatments. So that's a really good outcome at another level. So this whole monitoring and evaluation thing has become so big and so complex that I find there's a lot of resistance to it when it should be quite natural. And people can, you know, I listen to all these fights and discussions, and it's like, yes, in your project, if it's 6 months long, you might be saying that you're measuring your impact by people staying in the program for 6 months. And that's fine. And in a 10-year project, you're going to measure the impact by the decrease in mortality, decrease in number of deaths. But it doesn't matter what you put at the impact level, as long as it makes sense for what you are implementing.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's about finding the right balance.
You got it so, right the first time.
With that, are you ready for a little rapid fire session, Candela?
Absolutely.
Okay. So
I'm scared now.
Don't worry, you shouldn't. It's going to be fine. Welcome to our rapid fire segment called Insight Blitz, where we will ask you questions or read some statements and you will provide a brief response. Are you ready?
Sure.
What is your favorite thing to do in your spare time?
Play with my kid and read.
Love that. Wholesome. You started your career in biology and in the laboratory setting. What is one thing from that experience that has helped prepare you for a career in public health and global health?
Definitely not my capacity to pipette with both hands.
That's important too, though, right?
Yes, it's relatable.
Very well afterwards. You have no idea. I think the research mindset. Mm.
Wonderful. What is your favorite way to stay up to date with global health news?
My medium is reading, so I read a lot. I'm trying to get more and more into podcasts, but definitely the easiest medium for me is reading. Yeah.
With that, what is your favorite book that you've read? It doesn't have to be public health related, just out of curiosity.
Oof, that's a very tough question. I have like a 100 list. No. Yeah. I think one of the books that I enjoyed the most recently was some of the books that came out after COVID about the quest for vaccines. And, you know, it resonated about with my days back in the lab. And it was very inspiring to read about how people, you know, stayed nights at the lab trying to get things done and trying to make things go faster. There was so many people doing so many fantastic things.
What is your favorite part about creating and operating your own company?
The possibilities.
Ooh, I like that.
Leave it there.
Leave it there. Okay. Leaders are born, not raised. True or false?
False.
Why?
I think, I won't say everybody, but I think most people can become leaders. It's not rocket science. It's not magic. Definitely some people will have it easier, but it also depends, you know, the setting where someone is going to lead. That is very important. So the characteristics of your leader actually need to align with the settings or the needs, I would say.
Okay. With that, can you list some important traits of being a leader in global health?
Caring about people.
Okay, love that.
Okay,
and then
enough said.
Yeah, the last question of the Insight Blitz segment. Give us an elevator pitch on your book, Build Your Dream Team: Leadership Based on Passion for People.
Oh yeah, well, I wrote that book because that's a book I would have loved to have when I left the biomedical sciences and started my own team. We get absolutely no training as scientists, as researchers, as healthcare practitioners in, you know, management and leadership at all in all our years and years and years of study. So it's a big gap. And talking to people, I realized it's not just a gap in, you know, science and health or healthcare. It's a gap in many other careers as well. So it's a book for people who came into leadership through the back door, without a formal leadership or management training.
Thank you. So that's the end of that segment. How are you feeling?
Not great. Too bad, right? That was much less scary than I thought.
Okay. Wonderful. All right, I'll pass it over back to Gordon.
All right, so we'll take this home by talking about evidence sharing. And I know you had mentioned that's perhaps, of the three, one of the most interestingly challenging because of maybe how weak it is at the moment. So maybe I'll ask you a weird question first and you can give me a comment on that. Do we need some kind of YouTube or something like that for evidence sharing? Because it seems like one of the challenges with evidence sharing, so it's generating the evidence itself, documenting, sharing it, but is there a platform for that whole process to take place? That's kind of what I'm getting
at. I think
at.
There's several different platforms, and restricting those platforms, that's where we get it wrong, right? So peer review publications, super important, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of other issues, and we spend another hour talking about the problems with peer reviewed publications, which I'm sure you'd also know quite a lot about. So, but it's not the only one, right? Like, we need to communicate science and research and evidence to a huge variety of different people, and they're not going to use the same media. They're not going to have access to the same things, right? It's very hard to read a peer-reviewed publication. It takes a lot of time, a lot of concentration. There's a lot of jargon. It's not written for a general audience. So we we as public health practitioners, as global health practitioners, I think we all need to get a little bit better every day, every year at talking about evidence. And so that we expand that knowledge in whatever medium we're best at, right? So we're trying to do our side on the Landa. We're trying to write a short post on social media around, you know, different topics, non-communicable diseases, neglected tropical diseases, key concepts in global health and public health. But I think, you know, sometimes it's a press release. That's what I'm telling the organizations we work with. I'm not telling you to publish this in a peer-reviewed publication. That would be great. But you can also send an abstract to a conference. You can also, you know, create a meeting of several other organizations that are interested in this and have a workshop and discuss it. There's so many opportunities. And then how do you talk about this back to the communities? How do you talk about this back to the groups of people that were part of your study? I think we just need to keep being creating podcasts, YouTube, anything goes.
One other component of that I've been thinking about myself, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, is what role does publication bias have in blocking evidence sharing? So there is a propensity for example, if we do a very successful intervention in a positive way, it brings down the indicator, their health disparities, closes the gap, we're really excited to share, versus an intervention that didn't, maybe we executed it well and there was no benefit to the intervention that we could measure, there's perhaps less of a propensity to share those kinds of findings with the wider community. So what are your thoughts on that whole way of thinking as far as evaluation results and which ones would be shared versus others?
Definitely, you're totally right. And I just discussed this the other day in another podcast. We have such a terrible positive results bias. And that is true for the biomedical science. It's true for clinical sciences. It's true for global and public health. It's true all the way around. And that is a systemic problem. We can all contribute to solving it as individuals, but it starts from the journals, right? We know it's very hard to publish negative results in a journal. We know it's very hard to publish things that didn't work in a journal. And I think, you know, the clinical trials world have done a good job about, you know, for any clinical trial that you register, you should publish the data, but it's not that easy either, right? So, I mean, open publication, you know, this new archive sort of self-publishing non-peer-reviewed spaces are a good thing, but we still, it should still be possible to publish negative results in very high-level peer-reviewed publications. As you say, if your study was solid, great, you still need to publish it, even if it's negative results. And we're getting there with clinical trials, I think, but not with everything else. And then if your study did not turn out that solid, like if there were problems, if there were obstacles, if there something went wrong in the implementation, we can also learn from that, right? So we should be sharing that. Maybe not in a peer-reviewed publication, but there should be other mechanisms to share failures and lessons learned, because that's where we learn the most anyway.
Yeah, that, you said that. That reminds me. Yeah, that reminds me of, I can't remember where I heard it. I think a couple of years back, they actually held a failure conference where they actually just like talk about like their failures in the lab and like negative results. So all these people got together and were just sharing. And it's a valuable source of information because you could learn from those mistakes or things that didn't work out, right? So yeah, really
important stuff. I totally love it. And you know, the tech world has a lot of this fail fests. And I think that's something we should embrace in our hospitals. I mean, we know how important psychosocial safety is in a hospital team, right? So that, you know, clinical mistakes get detected on time and trying to solve them and so on. It's the same as public health practitioners, as global health practitioners. We should be creating the psychologically safe spaces to share the things that didn't work, because we're trying to do the best we can and everybody is, but we need to be learning from each other and also from the things that did not work.
Absolutely. So far in this conversation, we've been talking about the evidence base, evidence generating, evidence sharing. I want to wrap it all up and just take a couple of steps back here. What would you say to the 18-year-old version of yourself as it relates to your future career?
It's not a straight line. I think that's what I would say. We grow up, I don't know if it's still true today, but we grow up with such an idea that your career needs to be this step-by-step, stepwise, straight line trajectory where you're going from, you know, your bachelor's to your master's, potentially to your PhD if you're into research. And then, you know, maybe you need to do this and then you have your first level job. No, it's actually not like that. It doesn't have to be. It's great if it is. And if that's what you want, that's fantastic. But there's so much world to explore. There's so many things. You know, there's a lot of us that have just too many passions. And that's, for many years, I thought that was a negative. That I couldn't be just focused on one single thing and just go and become more and more specialized. Today, I think we need both. We need people who are highly specialized and we need people who understand components of various different fields and can bring the pieces together. So those people who, you know, jump careers, switch careers, try a little bit this, try a little bit that, they bring so much value if they're bringing those lessons learned from all their experiences. So yeah, I don't think it doesn't have to be a straight line, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And as you already mentioned earlier on, there wasn't a straight path in your career. There's a bunch of stoplights and U-turns and twists and bends. So with that, I'm sure you had some time to just reflect and think about some of these important lessons that you've learned throughout your career. I would ask you to share with me and Gordon and the audience, what would be your most impactful lesson that you've learned throughout all this?
It's all about people. It's all about the relationships you build. And, you know, I've been talking a lot about evidence and data, and it sounds so abstract. Seriously, it's been the relationships that I build that have helped me the most. And I'll give you just one example. I was once in a country where there was, I don't want to give too many details, but there was an outbreak and people were trying to figure out who in certain communities had gotten vaccinated and who had not. I was talking to community volunteers of a particular organization and they had been going house to house, talking to people, inviting them to get vaccinated and so on. And I said, oh, did you have some questionnaires there and so on? I just got curious about what they had been doing. And they came and they shared with me this, you know, they had these forms, they had this carpet, you know, these folders and folders and folders where they had filled out these forms. And they actually had asked in each household how many people had already gotten vaccinated. And all the big organizations were going crazy trying to figure out where were the higher vaccination needs and so on. And no one, they had it. It was there. It was on paper, of course, but they had done a very good work about it. It's about creating that trust and those relationships with people every single time for every particular piece of work that you want to do. That's my own lesson learned.
No, it's valuable to all of us. I'm sure we can take time, each of us, to reflect on the importance of these relationships in our lives, in our professional and personal lives. And then the last thing, I'd love to give you the opportunity to share any sort of take-home messages you have with our audience.
Well, because today we've been talking so much about data and evidence, and because I know you guys have an audience that it's very, you know, it's a lot of health and public health and global health professionals or students that are starting their path into global or public health, I would say you can make a difference. You can make a difference by strengthening some data. And it's about advocating for it, getting better at communicating it. Every small step that you take so that we individually improve, we can actually help to improve the systems as well.
Thank you so much, Candela. We had a wonderful time with you today. So thanks for coming on.
No, thank you so much for inviting me. It was really cool. I loved it. Fantastic discussions.
Thank you for listening to the Public Health Insight Podcast, your go-to space for informative conversations, inspiring community action. If you enjoy our podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. See you in the next one.